Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me my good friend, Venetia Archer. Venetia is founder of Ruby, a venture providing on-demand access to beauticians and therapists across London, Manchester, and Oxford. Prior to founding Ruby, Venetia was a geopolitical risk analyst tracking ship hijackings and ransom drop-offs in Somalia and Kenya. An alumnus of Founders Factory, the business has delivered over 200,000 bookings since inception. Venetia, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here with me today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So look, let's get straight into it. From Kenya to Kensington and from pirates to pedicures, can you talk us through the journey to establishing Ruby and why you felt like it needed to exist?
For sure. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, probably not that common to have someone who's been, you know, looking at Somali pirates and then building a beauty tech startup. But here we are, here I am. And I think for me, you know, I studied international relations at university, went into my first job in the sort of private security space and, you know, ended up specializing in Somali piracy, which is great fun, a great adventure, learned a huge amount. And it was exactly what I was meant to be doing, you know, when I was in my early 20s and experiencing the world. And I think that, you know, and I traveled a bit, I lived in Kenya and all those sorts of things. And I think once I got back to London and I was back in a big, you know, big corporate office, I, you know, had a little bit of time, had matured a tiny little bit and realized that I am definitely someone who likes to create. And I've always, you know, always throughout my life, I've always had business ideas and, you know, would sort of run these ideas all the time. And I got to the point where I realized that it was time for me to, you know, go off on my own and build something and try it. And I had a, you know, host of different ideas of things that I'd like to, you know, like to do, and as I still do now, but recognized that there seemed to be a pretty big gap in the market for on-demand beauty services. This was back in 2015. You know, we'd seen Uber come to town, Deliveroo, and I was, you know, avid user of these platforms, you know, and so sort of the concept, the idea of Ruby was born around then. And yeah, I mean, like, listen, the concept, the idea has evolved a lot over time, you know, since then. But yeah, it was just sort of one of those moments. And here we are.
Amazing. And at the time when you launched Ruby, presumably you weren't in that ecosystem, right? In terms of either beauty or in terms of tech. So how did you kind of navigate that back in 2015, 16?
Definitely. I mean, absolutely not. Could not have been further removed. But what I think I've always done is always, you know, for me, relationships, you know, building friendships, I don't like to say network, you know, building friendships with people, you know, has always been part of what I've done. And one of the first steps I did was, okay, change my hat from what I was doing previously, you know, to think about beauty and tech and try to leverage as many relationships with people in the space or have any idea from an adjacent space and could help me learn. And so I think, you know, I pushed hard and started to, you know, get informed about how one would launch a tech platform, what it would look like, how to even launch a business. Obviously, you know, at that point, you know, anyone who's even done anything around, you know, building a business, you know, would have, you know, huge insight and help for me. So yeah, it was very much a learning phase. And on the tech side, you know, I think given the fact that I didn't have very much of a background, what I did in terms of strategy was speak with as many individual developers or agencies or, you know, whoever it might be to sort of kind of build out my understanding of what the product would or should look like. And then I went from there and then we ended up working with a relatively pretty small agency, like one or two developers to sort of build out that MVP, which was, you know, kind of did the trick at the beginning. But definitely, you know, obviously the product has evolved a huge amount since then. And I think I was very lucky back in 2015 or 2016 when we launched, people had a little bit more patience because I think even when we launched, I can't even remember if people could sign in. But yeah, we got there in the end.
Amazing. And you also sort of participated in Founders Factory. So how did you find that? And was that kind of a valuable boost to either your knowledge or your understanding of the venture ecosystem? Or was it more about the relationships that you could build within the ecosystem to grow further?
I think it was definitely, you know, we made that decision because, you know, we were a small, scrappy startup. And I knew there was still a lot more to learn about, you know, different verticals within a business, operations, marketing, commercial. And by joining the Founders Factory ecosystem, I was able to access, you know, incredible knowledge in one place and really help me refine out the strategy of the business, you know, including things like hiring plans and stuff like that. So it was, you know, like a bit of a startup school. So it definitely served, you know, very beneficial and helpful purpose, you know, for me at that time.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're big fans of Founders Factory here on the podcast, and we had David Hickson on, who was one of the founding team earlier in the season. And I think, you know, the way he describes it is unlike traditional accelerators. It's less about kind of pumping, you know, the cohort through 3 or 4 months of specific training, but actually giving them access to talent, access to their networks, access to their understanding and their knowledge, which I completely agree can be really valuable when you're coming into that founding kind of position where you have multiple hats and you may have been used to only wearing one or maybe even two of those hats, to then have to kind of branch out into things where you maybe have less comfort, whether that's tech, whether that's commercial, whether that's operations, as you say. And, you know, moving forward a little bit, like the 2 years during the pandemic must have been super tough, right? With business under government mandated shutdown for, you know, massive periods of time. So I think it was like 9 or 10 months where the business was effectively under an enforced close. What allowed you to keep the doors open? And, you know, how do you think the business has come out of the pandemic?
So I think what I call, I mean, the pandemic, I mean, it was like the COVID MBA when it comes to the business. You know, I think I learned more over that period of time than, you know, the rest of my journey combined. I mean, revenues went to zero overnight, had to make some seriously difficult decisions without really knowing what we were dealing with. We didn't know how long the pandemic would last. We didn't know when we'd be able to resume services. We just didn't really know what we were facing. And so I think that, you know, I sort of got into that like crystal clear thinking, like this is crisis mode. And so basically got the business into a position of being super, super agile. We cut all additional costs, you know, every single additional cost. One thing that we did do was we maintained our tech, you know, at least part of our tech team to continue to build our product. You know, as everyone knows, businesses are always behind when it comes to tech product. And we thought, okay, let's make the gamble. Let's continue to invest there. So, you know, we're that step ahead on the other side of things. But listen, none of it was easy. And then we'd have moments of being able to operate for a time, but we'd only be able to offer certain services. So there was a lot of work that had to go behind that. Then there was building out, you know, COVID protocol. So what I did once we sort of dealt with the initial response was, you know, I thought, okay, what can I do that's of value? And what I did was really build out Ruby's reputation with, you know, industry bodies or, you know, associated, you know, governmental bodies, you know, to support and guide where possible when it came to, you know, how the mobile beauty industry should react. And so, you know, again, a new hat. And I think that, you know, definitely elevated Ruby's reputation in this space and also helped me to build out my learnings. What we also did was focus on our community. We've got over 1,000 freelancers who work with us. You know, fine, Ruby can't operate, but none of these, you know, all of these individuals, their revenue went to zero overnight as well. So really tried to be an educational force. So as soon as we had any information, you know, we would share that immediately with the community, not just the Ruby community, you know, the whole kind of mobile community where we could, and did stuff, you know, just tried to do anything that we could to make people feel less alone. Workshops, calls, all those terrible things like quizzes on Zoom, all of that stuff we were doing, just so at least, you know, everyone felt like they weren't just sitting on their own in their living room. So listen, it was still a busy time. But, you know, again, there was that fear, you know, obviously, you know, money was super tight and huge, you know, it was hugely kind of nerve-wracking, you know, being in that position, you know, will we get by, will we get through the other side? But we did. And I think that we were really lucky in the sense that post-pandemic, there had been this consumer shift, obviously, because people were at home, they're spending more time at home. This sense of on demand became much more normal. And so I think there was this, you know, real excitement, new found excitement about at-home services. So our numbers jumped post-pandemic. Like I think April 2021 was when we were able to fully resume. Numbers absolutely jumped. Completely new demographics were using us. Really loyal demographics as well. I think that this was compounded by the fact that there was a, you know, another shift on the salon space. So you'd seen 30% of closures of salons on the high street. Beauty therapists, wellness practitioners started to want to work freelance. So you'd see the shift from salon to freelance. And then we were kind of, you know, sat there ready, you know, ready to offer these people work. So it all kind of worked out nicely. And I think on top of that, I think, again, like for myself as a, you know, as a founder, as a CEO, I really had the time to refine out strategy and vision, had to be, you know, pretty aggressive when it came to making, you know, tough decisions, you know, so was able to make what I thought were the best decisions for the business quite quickly. And so our whole strategy changed, the whole team dynamic changed, structure of the team, commercial areas of focus. It was a completely different business. And, you know, we're operating now in an infinitely more efficient way and better way than we were pre-pandemic.
That's amazing. And I think one of the things, having obviously, and I think, you know, full disclosure to the listeners, I worked with Venetia for a couple of years, right through till the end of last year. You know, one of the things that I think was astounding for me was, as you say, firstly, how quickly business was able to resume post-pandemic. So I think it's testament to that, you know, flexibility and agility, as you say, in terms of your ability to move the business model as you needed to. The second thing that I think really strikes me as being, again, you know, we've talked a lot about shifts in e-commerce with massive sort of additional adoption of online shopping, but on demand, I think, was going through a little bit of a flat phase, right? In, let's say, 2018, 2019, people were starting to get a little bit fed up of some of Uber's shenanigans, let's say, and maybe there were some questions around the gig economy. But what was really clear during the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, was that this whole cohort of workers, you know, this was not a sort of, this was a choice, right? Like this was not about, you know, evil corporations trying to take advantage. This was about flexibility. It was about, you know, potentially a second sort of job that people wanted to take on or to work the hours that they could work, where in a salon, as you say, maybe they've got to be there, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever those hours may be. And they suddenly cottoned on to the fact that, well, actually, if I work on my own time and to the customer's needs, then actually that gives everyone more flexibility. And, you know, I would say that, you know, certainly as a consumer myself, we've had some significant shifts in our attitude to where we go and do things, whether that's outdoors or not. So, you know, we continue to get shopping delivered to the door. We may go to the supermarket a little bit more often than we did during the pandemic, but nowhere near what we were doing previously. And equally, the sort of services that you're talking about, you know, which effectively could be, you know, hair, nails, pedicures and massages and various other services, for sure, we're kind of more likely to have those at home than we are to go to a salon or a high street sort of shop. So as a founder, you've got to prioritize a multitude of things, right? As you were just saying, what is the one metric that you and the team focus on, like, relentlessly to track your progress?
So I think, you know, the basics, number one is GMV, so total sales in a day. Obviously, I'm looking at that and refreshing that like a demon. You know, I think that's the kind of fundamental metric. But really, you know, when you dig down into that a little bit, I think probably, you know, what's really important is customer retention. You know, it's great. You can sort of throw tons of cash on a customer acquisition, but if they use you once and don't book again, obviously that's a huge problem. So for us, it's making sure that we maintain solid month-on-month customer retention and that we can see the evolution of the customer booking behavior over time. So within that, we look at repeat booking rates, the frequency of repeat booking rates, the average number of bookings, and how that evolves and hopefully grows over time, which is something that we do see. So what we see in terms of customer behaviors is that they join, they'll do X number of bookings, and then over time that number of bookings increases in, you know, on the month because they start to trust us more, you know, not just for one category, but multiple categories. So we also look at the proportion of our users who are using us for multiple categories. And again, you know, hope to see that evolve over time. So
I think it's like 14% of our customers have used us for 9+ categories, which is, for me, it's you know, pretty amazing because we do such a breadth of services. But I think, you know, again, it indicates the trust that they have in the platform and that educational piece over time. So that's definitely not one KPI I've just spoken about. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, there isn't always just one. There are several that are just as important as each other. I think the one that I really like is retention because, you know, in sort of growth businesses and technology businesses, there's a lot of there's a lot of time devoted to, you know, customer acquisition and growth. But I always think about it as, you know, if you have to acquire a customer and can't keep them, then they're not that valuable to you. Whereas if you can spend your time and your money keeping those customers on platform, you know, continue to use your service month on month, week on week, whatever it might be. And as you say, across multiple services, then that's actually more valuable than, you know, spending your time trying to bring on an additional customer that may only get you, you know, one or two bookings. So I think that retention metric is really important. And I think also is one that is not well enough understood, right? Because first of all, I think a lot of people don't quite understand how you can track that, right? And how you can think about net retention. And I think equally, as I say, people are just far too focused on the acquisition metric rather than the retention metric. So I think that makes a huge amount of sense. So you've raised in excess of £2 million from a variety of incredible investors and family offices. What has been most challenging on that fundraising journey? And what do you wish you knew then that you know now?
I think that, you know, one thing I'll say about fundraising is, you know, obviously it's very challenging and all of those sorts of things that everyone talks about. But what I always find is that I am such a better leader. I know so much more about my business post-raise. You know, you really are forced to look and answer the difficult questions. So it's, you know, I think that they're almost like good moments in time to take stock, which, you know, is obviously a great thing to do. So I have grown to love the fundraising process because, you know, it's very helpful for me. You know, you have these, you know, incredible conversations about the business. You're talking big, you're thinking about the future, and it's time where you're not kind of spent analyzing a lot of the day to day, which can, you know, obviously sort of things go in waves as a founder. So, you know, it's a great moment. In terms of challenges, I think that, you know, I think that in the early days, you know, especially kind of, you know, launching in to this whole startup kind of community, there's a lot of like excitement and talk about big ticket raises, you know, blue chip VCs. And I think there's a lot of associated glamour there. And of course, you know, there's huge benefits to raising from experienced VCs. But I think that there's probably not as much of an understanding about how there are multiple ways to access capital, whether through family office, whether through angel rounds, whether through, you know, crowdfunding or whatever it might be. And I think what I've learned is that, you know, at different stages on our journey, you know, we've needed different kinds of capital. And so I think that it took us time to really build out Ruby to where it is today. You know, it's a marketplace, it's challenging. You know, at the beginning, maybe the market wasn't ready. And so as a result, you know, for us in the early days, you know, we really appealed to angels and family office who got the vision and were happy to entrust me with building that out. And yeah, so that's definitely been a learning.
I think you're the first person I've ever heard say that they've come to love the fundraising process. That is something that I don't tend to hear from a lot of founders.
Listen, I can't even believe I'm saying that, but there we go.
Yeah, no, precisely.
You know, I think like change the mindset, it's fun, like not worry. You know, I think I used to worry, oh, you know, you'd have these conversations, people would like rip your business to shreds and say, absolutely not. And, you know, go home and, you know, devastated. And now I take it with a pinch of salt. And I think because of time, you know, I've had time to see the business grow. I have this like innate confidence that's not just about the vision, but it's also about the metrics and the traction. And so if I do get those no's, which obviously I do, you know, you get God knows, you know, tons of no's, it might not work for them, whatever it might be. But instead of allowing that to really impact me, I don't, you know, I just realize, okay, if you get a no, then reach out to another 10 people. Like it's a numbers game. I think that's something that we've spoken about today. It's just a numbers game.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think it's sort of like you need the 100 conversations to get the, you know, to get to the yes. And I think you know, firstly, testament to both, you know, the business, but also your ability to sell the business. You know, you have raised a fairly substantial amount of capital from some pretty interesting people over the course of, you know, the last several years. And I think one thing you said there that I think really struck me as being true, and that we need to kind of talk about more within the tech and venture ecosystem, is at different stages of a business, there are different needs for capital, right? Like there are both different needs for capital in the business, but different types of capital that are needed, right? So as you said earlier on, you know, when you're in that sort of nascent period, obviously it's the friends and family that are going to back you. It's the people that kind of trust you and want to see you succeed. And then as you move forward, it's potentially those high net worths and those family offices that really have, you know, an understanding of your passion and can see that vision. And then, you know, once you start printing metrics and numbers, that's when you, certainly in the UK, that's when you start kind of looking at VCs as an alternative source of capital. And of course, along that journey, there are other sources of capital as well. You know, during the pandemic, obviously, there were a number of loans that were on offer. But, you know, even outside of those, things like revenue-based financing, et cetera, which can work for businesses that are driven by sort of, you know, consumer behavior. So I think the takeaway, though, there that is really important, and I think I would like for more founders to have that attitude and for more people to understand that, is the more you start enjoying the process and understanding why the no's happen and what are the questions that you have to ask yourself and what are the things that you have to challenge yourself about in your business, you know, the more positive the outcome of those conversations can be, right? Like, I mean, I think a lot of founders get, to your point, right? They get swept up in the narrative of TechCrunch or, you know, Business Insider or whoever's just raised that last large round. And they get a lot of kind of fear of missing out around that. But, you know, venture is a very small piece of the ecosystem, let's say. Well, it's not small, but it's not the only piece of the ecosystem. And it's only suitable for certain businesses at a certain time, right? And equally, there are so many venture capital funds that you may end up talking to a bunch who just aren't the right fit in any case, right? And then it just takes the one conversation with the one partner at the right firm, you know, for things to click. And I think that's the other thing that really needs to be kind of highlighted, you know, certainly here in the UK and Europe, because we don't have the same ecosystem as the US does in terms of very early stage, where VCs, you know, will effectively pour in, you know, on the back of not much more than a deck or, you know, in some cases, something scribbled on the back of a napkin. So look, as we kind of round off, this podcast is all about the entrepreneurial journey. That's why I called it Nothing Ventured. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but when you launched Ruby, you know, back in 2016, you didn't have a tech background, as you said, but you dive straight in and you use a number of kind of avenues to shore up that knowledge. But I'd really love to understand what advice you'd give to non-technical founders looking to launch today. And then, you know, on top of that, given that you're so kind of embedded in the ecosystem, how has the entrepreneurial landscape changed since you've been operating?
So I think for non-technical founders, I don't think there's a problem with being a non-technical founder, but I think that there's definitely work that needs to be done to ensure that you are making the right decisions if you're building a technical product. And, you know, there are many ways in which to do that. So for me, again, as I mentioned, building out network in that space, you know, in the first instance, and the second was, you know, one of my first key hires was our CTO, Pete. You know, he had 15 years of experience in the industry. He'd previously worked at Net-a-Porter. He spoke my language and he spoke the tech language. So, you know, he's taught me a huge amount. And, you know, because I knew, okay, I've got this skill set. What is the main skill set that's lacking? Okay, hire for that. Really, you know, focus on building that expertise in-house. So, you know, definitely be practical about where your skill set lies and fill the gaps. And if they're technical, fill them there first. You know, and I've been fine. You know, that's definitely worked for me. And, you know, as I say, you know, you do learn, you know, a hell of a lot over time. In terms of how the entrepreneurial landscape has changed, I think there's a lot more resources and knowledge out there because so many more people have sort of started and are leading the way. Back when I launched, it wasn't as common. I mean, not, I don't know if it's common or not. Maybe it just feels common because it's the world that I'm living in. But it wasn't, you know, not everyone had an idea that they were actually actively working on. And I definitely think that the pandemic has, you know, precipitated shift towards people building out their dreams because they had more time to reflect on it. So there's definitely more resources and support available. I think there's just a sort of a commonality of understanding and knowledge that there wasn't there previously. Yeah. So I think that it's definitely a much more appealing space to be in. I think there's a greater sense of community available to founders because there are simply more people doing it. So, you know, I love the space. I think that one of the things that has truly helped me has always been like build out my tribe. And that comes with, you know, people who are in the same space, you know, building businesses as well, dealing with the same practical day-to-day issues or challenges that I may be facing, but then also building out that network of mentors, people who've done it before, people who've been successful, not even just in the same industry, but in adjacent industries, you know, learn from others, learn from the mistakes of others so that you don't necessarily make them yourself. Listen, as a founder, as an entrepreneur, you're going to make a billion mistakes. The mistakes I made tons of them along the way and still make them now. But as long as you minimize through learning, and to make sure that you rapidly shift course if you have made a mistake, it's fine. It's fine. It's normal. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful way of looking at it. I think the first thing to pick up on there is this idea of picking up people with complementary skills, right? So making sure that you balance your skill sets out with others that, as you say, fill the gaps where you don't have the experience. And I think a lot of founders try to do everything and don't recognize that they can't, right? And therefore, you know, you may get founders who learn to code and build a product, but, you know, they completely kind of over-engineer or under-engineer it because they don't have, you know, they've never shipped anything before, so they don't really know what they're doing. And I think the other thing that really I think is massively important is this idea of fast learning, right? So not taking, you know, mistakes or failures as a negative, but actually taking them as an opportunity. And I think this is one of the things I talk about this quite a bit on the podcast, certainly when we talk about entrepreneurialism, is this issue I think we have in the UK where we have a very negative view of failure, right? Like in terms of business failure, especially where there's a lot of negativity around it. There's a lot of stigma around it. And I think that's one of the challenges that people going into entrepreneurship face is, well, what if I fail? And, you know, unlike in the US where most people will just get back up on their feet and it's a badge of pride. It's a badge of honor to be, you know, to have been through that mill of entrepreneurship. And I think that's starting to change a little bit here in the UK. And I think to your point, that's partly driven by just the number of people that are now, you know, starting an entrepreneurial journey. And I think one thing that is really important, again, to say is that being an entrepreneur doesn't mean building a tech business, right? That is an avenue for entrepreneurship. Like you and I have talked about various sort of different types of businesses that could be interesting. And, you know, there is nothing wrong with, you know, building a bakery or doing an online e-com store. Just is something that gives you the ability to A, pursue something that you've wanted to do, B, earn additional income, but also learn a huge amount, right? Because I think there is no better learning than running your own business, because you have to think about so many different things. You have to think about the team that you have underneath you, but equally, you have to think about how to build consistently and to grow over time. Now, obviously, with venture-backed businesses, those we tend to talk about fast growth, but actually growth in and of itself is just as valuable as fast growth. If anything, it's more valuable because you probably have more time to learn than if you're just sort of shoveling cash into the burner and into the rocket engine and trying to grow exponentially. So I think that's a really lovely way of looking at it. And obviously, you know, you're what, 5-6 years into this journey. So I'm guessing you've got a way to go still in terms of what you want to achieve. I mean, it'd be great to understand from you, like, where do you see Ruby ultimately heading?
Oh my gosh. I mean, like the sky is the limit, you know, the sky's the limit. I feel like this is all, you know, everything to date has really been the kind of the groundwork. You know, people have said to me in the past, it takes 5 years to really build a business. Obviously, like when I was, you know, pre-5 years, I'm like, oh my God, that feels like such a long time. But now I've hit that mark. I'm like, oh, you know what? I get it. Like, because I understand the levers of the business. I understand and have confidence in the product market fit and where I want the business to go, and recognize that there are, you know, I have the tools in which to achieve that. So, you know, I see this as being a global business. You know, I want Ruby to be, you know, the app that you have on your phone, like with Uber, when you get off the Eurostar, you book your Uber to your hotel. Fine, you know, you download Ruby or you already have it on your phone, actually. But, you know, you book your blow dry appointment for your meetings the next day. That's the way that I see it. You know, I think that the industry, I mean, it's ripe for continued disruption. I think that we've learned a hell of a lot about how to do it well. And, you know, I'm excited for what comes next. I also have a million little ideas that I cannot wait to do one day, but those change all the time. And right now, my great love is Ruby. Oh my God, that was such a cheesy line.
I think that's amazing. No, I don't know. I mean, like, let's face it, right? If you're a founder without that sort of passion, then you're probably in the wrong game. So no, I think that's an amazing sentiment to kind of finish the podcast on. So look, Venetia, for our listeners, you know, where can they find you online? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Instagram? Where can they find you?
You can find us on Instagram at Ruby App. We're on Twitter as well at Ruby App. And then, but more importantly, download us on the App Store and Play Store. And you can find us online at www.ruby.com.
Amazing. Venetia, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thanks, Arish. This was so fun. Great to talk to you.
Amazing. Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.